May it please the court, Paul Gordon on behalf of 1117 Summit Trail, or 1117, yes. And we are the appellants in this case. This is a legal malpractice case. It was decided on summary judgment grounds, so I need to go into the facts because the facts are relevant to whether, as a matter of law, summary judgment should have been entered. The underlying case was a transactional malpractice case, and the sole question on which summary judgment was entered was causation, whether or not, more probably than not, or backing up, whether a reasonable jury could conclude that more probably than not, the errors confessed for the purposes of summary judgment standards were a cause of damages, and the argument specifically being that the clients, my clients, would not have entered into the contract had they known about the opportunity to enter into the contract. And so on the question of the evidence that was available to the judge, there are numerous facts that I wanted to briefly summarize. I think I have 10 total that I think are key facts. The first is that the second lender who made the offer to enter into this contract did in fact make an offer and was there. That's evidence that they were willing to enter into this contract.
Excuse me for interrupting. Mr. Gordon, are these 10 facts that are generally relevant or show that there are material facts in dispute that should have precluded the entry of summary judgment?
The latter. These are facts that when you take them as a whole, no one fact could prove causation in this case. But as the law is in many jurisdictions, I don't know that it's been quite articulated in this jurisdiction, you can prove causation in a transactional malpractice case through circumstantial evidence. And so I'm just laying out the 10 circumstances that tend to prove that there was a question for the jury to resolve, and it was an error on the trial court's part to take the case away from the jury. So there was, in fact, an offer to enter into a contract. The numbers, which I'll lay out as multiple facts, this was a $2.6 million condominium. In order to take advantage of the second lender's offer, all they had to do was purchase the second lender's position for $40,000, which shows you that, and then if they had purchased that opportunity, they could have acquired this $2.6 million condominium for $1.9 million. So there was an opportunity for substantial profit with very low risk if you just purchased that second lender's position for $40,000. Those are circumstances from which a reasonable jury could conclude that more probably than not, had my clients known that they had the opportunity to purchase the second lender's position, they would have done that and they would have taken advantage of that profit opportunity. In fact, an additional fact, that second lender did sell his its interest, its second priority, to someone else who learned about the opportunity. And that tends to show that the opportunity was genuine. This wasn't some sort of sham being perpetuated by the second lender. And in this case, when the additional other person purchased the second lender's position, the junior lenders did not exercise their peremptory rights, which has the tendency to prove that more probably than not, my clients, and I'm only saying my clients because 1117 Summit Trail gets to be cumbersome, more probably than not, my clients would have been able to take advantage of the opportunity to receive that profit.
So as you're going through this, which I hope you will essentially address this question, I understand that Mr. is it Lederer, the 30B6 designate, testified about this, about whether Summit would have or could have. And what did he say?
What he said was, once had they learned that they had an opportunity to purchase the second lender's position, which at the time I believe was offered for $41,000, they would have tried to negotiate. They would have said, "Well, we'll offer $10,000." But that's not inconsistent with a finding that more probably than not they would have reached a contract. It's simply a statement on their part that they would have kept the negotiations going.
But how do we know that? I mean, as opposed to Mr. Lederer saying, well, we were offering $5,000 to $10,000. I mean, you could say on the one hand, $5,000 to $10,000 is either an initial negotiating position or it's a bottom line that we're not going to offer anything more than $10,000.
Well, because his testimony was we would negotiate. He did not say that was our bottom line. Had he said that was our bottom line, and had they then come in with the HRA saying, well, we wouldn't have accepted $10,000, we would have a different fact pattern here. But we don't have those facts. And in fact, I don't remember honestly if this was in the record or not. When it was sold to the other person, it was sold for $20,000.
And that was a few days later. So we know that, I mean, it seems highly unlikely they would have accepted 10 when at the same time they've got an offer on the table for 20.
It was a couple of weeks later, and the offer for 20 was not on the table at the time that that the offer was presented to my clients.
Through a lawyer who would have had to communicate it back to your clients, who would have had to talk about it and think about it, who would have had to get back to the lawyer, and all this takes time. I mean, are you saying the lawyer should have instantaneously, on his own, purchased the or entered into negotiations to purchase for $40,000?
No, I think you're correct in suggesting that it's a process that takes time. The actual sequence of events was that there was a verbal communication of the offer in the middle of November, and then there was a written communication of the offer a couple of weeks later. My clients still don't know about it. Then it's in the middle of December that another purchaser comes in and purchases the priority. So there was time. There was a month as a practical matter. So no, we're not saying it had to happen instantaneously, but it certainly had to happen within a reasonable amount of time. And since the sole question here is causation, I think a reasonable jury can conclude that a month was a reasonable amount of time.
But what evidence was there presented in connection with the summary judgment motion that your clients would have gone above $10,000? In connection with the summary judgment motion.
Mr. Schlesinger testified that my clients would have paid the full amount had they known about the opportunity. They would have been willing to do that.
But wasn't that affidavit submitted after summary judgment was entered?
No, it was part of the deposition testimony, which was submitted attached to the response to the original motion for summary judgment.
Well, Mr. Gordon, what is your response to Judge Martinez's conclusion that Mr. Schlesinger had no authority to bind Summit Trail?
My response is that goes to the weight of the evidence and not to the admissibility of the evidence, and it doesn't go to whether or not it raises a question of fact for the jury to decide. Now, if what we were talking about was, let's say I had pulled some random stranger off the street who came in and said, well, 1117 would have been willing to purchase this for $41,000. Maybe that would have been different, but that's not the facts of this case. He wasn't the named shareholder of 1117, but he was actively involved and well-versed in what 1117 was actually doing and what they were interested in doing.
But then if he's not authorized to speak on behalf of 1117, then anything he has to say about that is hearsay. He can't bind the company. He's not an officer of the company. So what he knows as a result of hearsay. And in response to a summary judgment motion, you have to present evidence that would be admissible at trial.
Well, to be precise, what he's saying is that the entity would have been willing, based on his observations of the activities of the entity. So to some extent, to be able to get inside the mind of an entity is...
How can we do that when he's not a part of the entity?
We couldn't do it even if he was a part of the entity.
Sure we could. He could be a member of the LLC. Like his wife was the controller of the trust, she was a member of the LLC. I mean, why don't we have her affidavit? She could get into the mind because she's part of it. He's an outsider. He is somebody off the street.
No, he's not somebody off the street. It's a little like saying if you witness a car accident and you're standing 100 feet away or 300 feet away or 10 miles away.
No, the person who's watching the car accident can testify as to what he saw, but he can't testify as to what the drivers were thinking and what they would have done. That's what you're saying Mr. Schlesinger should have been allowed to say, what they would have done, what they were thinking and what their intent was.
Well, I agree with you that if he testifies to what they were thinking, then yes, he has to do that. by learning about it from a member, and that would be hearsay. But that's not all that he says. He's saying that more probably than not, they would have accepted the offer based on his personal knowledge of the activities of the entity. Whether he's an employee of the entity, whether he is a member of the entity, all of that goes to the weight of the evidence.
He's not anything. He's not an employee. He's not anything relating to the entity.
He was Linda Pastel's husband, personal advisor, actively involved in the management of Linda Pastel's money. He had $8 million in cash. He personally could have invested into the business. So he's not nobody. He's clearly not nobody. And I would point out to you that we're not utterly dependent on his testimony in order to raise a question of fact for the jury to decide. He's just an additional witness. Finally, in terms of facts that raise a question of fact for the jury to decide, actually purchasing the second lien's position is an improvement for the fourth lien, which was what my client was. And there's some confusion about this, so I wanted to clarify this. The argument has been made by the attorneys in this case that no, people want to get the junior position because that gives them a chance to purchase the property. And that's true, but they have to purchase the property at a higher price. The opportunity here was to purchase the property at a lower price. It was the profit that created the motive to get into this business. All of these are facts from which a reasonable jury could have concluded, and that more probably than not, the malpractice and the failure to communicate the opportunity was a cause of damages. I have 3 minutes left, and I will reserve that time.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you.
May it please court and counsel. I am Ron Nemiro of Kennedy Childs, number 15178, and I'm appearing here for the appellees, Bloom, Marin, Akamazo, and Joseph Muir individually. This legal malpractice case presents two issues for this court to decide. Excuse me. Neither issue is novel, neither issue is difficult. The first is whether the loss of a mere opportunity is compensable under Colorado law. The answer to that is a resounding no. The second issue is whether summary judgment is properly granted where the party opposing it presents no admissible evidence on issues on which that party bears the burden of proof. The answer to that question is, under Colorado law, an equally resounding yes. I'll discuss each of these issues in order. Is the mere loss of an opportunity compensable under Colorado law? Because that's what we're talking about here, is the loss of an opportunity. Mr. Gordon pointed out how difficult it is to find out what a corporate entity is thinking. But under Colorado law and the facts of this case, it's not difficult at all, because 30B6 is the rule that allows us to know what a corporation is thinking. 30B6 is the rule that creates a spokesman who is designated to tell you what the corporation's position is. Here, the 30B6 spokesman was Mr. Lederer. And here, Mr. Lederer testified that had he known of the offer by the HOA, and we're assuming for the purposes of this argument that he did not, had he known of that offer, he would have negotiated. Left up in the air is how the negotiations would have turned out. It is undisputed, though, that that was Mr. Lederer's testimony. It is undisputed that that testimony was no mere slip of the tongue. Rather, it was the testimony that Mr. Semler, plaintiff's expert and something of a jack-of-all-trades in this case, it was that testimony that Mr. Semler assumed to be true for the purposes of his opinion. Speaking of Mr. Semler, I would point out something that Mr. Gordon sort of circumvented, and that is that the buyer of the HOA's interest was Mr. Semler. So Mr. Semler is not only their expert, but he is also the competitor of, as it turns out, the law firm and the rival in the bidding. I half expected to see him manning the security machines out this morning. However, the fact that Mr. Semler purchased the HOA's interest throws him a complete monkey wrench into what would have happened. Because Mr. Semler represented, in essence, the junior leaner waiting out in the wings to bid against senior lien holder interests. In any event, this is a case that involves the loss of that opportunity to negotiate. And that opportunity is not compensable under Colorado law, and for good reason from a policy standpoint. Especially in a legal malpractice case in a transactional setting, it doesn't make sense to recognize as compensable damages the loss of an opportunity. To recognize those as compensable damages puts the client, gives an advantage to the client whose lawyer fails to convey an offer. Because under those circumstances, the client whose lawyer fails to convey an offer can come into court and seek damages representing the loss of his prospects. Whereas a client whose lawyer does convey an offer only gets the benefit of the offer if the deal is consummated.
Mr. Nimmer, what if Mr. Letterer had said that they would have been willing to purchase the lien for the $41,000?
Even that, I think, would fall short of the certainty necessary to defeat summary judgment because of the uncertainty represented by Mr. Semler and the junior liener. And not just that uncertainty, but the inability of the plaintiff to show that they could have financed the redemption. So that there's screen after screen of uncertainty. There's a fog of uncertainty throughout this entire transaction. That it is poor public policy to recognize loss of a chance is something that has been part of Colorado law at least since Kaiser versus Sharp in 1987, and it continues to be part of Colorado law in the cases that Judge Jones authored last year, Ludlow and Regal. Mere loss of a chance is not compensable. That takes me to the second issue in this case. Is summary judgment properly granted when the side moving for it presents admissible evidence supporting its position and the side opposing it presents no admissible evidence at all? Because that, too, is what happened in this case. I think Judge Jones was correct in pointing out that Mr. Schlesinger, speaking legally, was a complete stranger to Summit. Mr. Schlesinger, to know what a corporation thinks, to know a corporation's intent, requires one to be part of the corporation or to be a spokesperson for the corporation. For an outsider to know what a corporation is thinking requires hearsay. One can no more know directly what a corporation is thinking than one can know directly what someone is dreaming. You need to have that conveyed to you, and that is hearsay. In Summit's briefs, Summit compares Schlesinger to a witness of a motor vehicle accident, just as Mr. Gordon compared him here. But as the court noted, that comparison is inapt because a witness of a motor vehicle accident has direct sensory data and not the hearsay evidence that intent requires. It would not have taken much for Summit to defeat summary judgment in this case had the evidence supported it. As the D.R. Horton case teaches us, in the face of 30B6 testimony from a corporate party, that can be defeated by a subsequent affidavit from the 30B6 deponent, if indeed the deponent can swear to that. Or it can be defeated by other evidence. But here, no admissible evidence was submitted in any meaningful way. Such sworn evidence as was submitted at the last possible moment. And that was, it accompanied the reply in support of the motion to reconsider. And that evidence is generally and properly not considered either by the trial court or by this court. It's important to keep in mind the arguments that Summit does not make. Summit never argued that the 30B6 request was itself improper. Summit never argued that Letterer's testimony was not binding upon it. Summit never argued that Letterer's testimony was itself inadmissible or misconstrued. And Summit never argued that Letterer simply misspoke. To the contrary, Summit selected Lederer as its 30B6 designate. And someone had not just the opportunity, but the affirmative legal duty to prepare Mr. Lederer to testify on these matters. But Mr. Lederer's testimony was that Summit would have negotiated. And that in itself is not compensable. It is correct and proper that Colorado law should not recognize loss of an opportunity to negotiate as compensable damages, and the trial court's order here should be affirmed.
Mr. Nimmer, what's your response to Mr. Gordon's contention that Mr. Lederer's statement about willingness to negotiate at least presents a genuine issue of fact, because we don't know what it would have negotiated, and under these circumstances, clearly that would have led to an inference that they would have been willing to pay more than $10,000.
I think that's the loss of a chance argument that this court's declined to recognize, in let alone in Regal, and that the Supreme Court has shown sort of a reluctance to even consider in Sharp 2.
Could you explain the policy to me, counsel? Let's assume for the sake of argument that we have undisputed evidence that a seller asked for $75,000 but would have taken $50,000, and undisputed evidence that to a particular buyer they would have paid $1 million for this, because to this particular buyer it's worth that for some specific reason. Why under those circumstances wouldn't the loss of an opportunity to negotiate be enough, because it's clear that the buyer would pay whatever the seller wanted?
Well, I think under those circumstances that would be enough.
Well, but that's a loss of an opportunity merely, right? We don't have a specific offer.
We would have a specific offer if there was undisputed evidence that there was an offer within the range that was within the scope of the lawyer's authority to accept. I think that would create an issue of fact, as a number of the cases that plaintiffs cite show.
Okay,
but that's not the evidence here.
So would you just draw that distinction for me then? Why is that different from the situation here?
The situation here is that we don't know on the one hand what the HOA would have accepted, we don't know on the other hand what Summit would have offered, and we don't know what Mr. Semler or Julian Winters would have done. We don't know what Summit would have done in terms of redeeming the property.
Why wouldn't the amount that the HOA ultimately accepted be some evidence of the first question?
It might be some evidence of the first question, but there would be no evidence of the subsequent questions. And that amount of uncertainty would defeat summary judgment. I mean, the party opposing summary judgment would have to put up evidence to show that there's an issue on that. Here, there's no such evidence.
Okay, thank you.
If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nemiro.
I have 3 points I want to make on reply. The first is to remind the court that the test, even at trial, would not be to prove causation with certainty. You only have to prove causation in terms of more probably than not what would happen. We could never meet the burden of proof. I'll be the first to confess that. If the burden of proof is certainty, we'll never meet it. The second is that I want to address this loss of chance argument, because the counsel has conflated the difference between causation and damages. All of those cases that say we don't recognize loss of chance are cases where the court is saying we don't recognize loss of chance as a damage. What this case is about is loss of chance as a link in the causal chain. But we'll keep right on going in the analysis and get to the point where we've got an appraisal that'll say it's a $2.6 billion property. You only need $1.9 million to pay for it. This is not a loss of chance case. And finally, Your Honors, much is made, certainly made in the briefs and almost made here, that somehow Mr. Semler did something wrong by acquiring this opportunity. Well, that's not the issue before this court, but he certainly did not do anything wrong. He gave my clients, through their lawyers, the defendants, a month to try and exercise this opportunity. He certainly fulfilled his fiduciary duties to his client. But that gets us into a whole discussion that I don't have a time to discuss, which is, what if there are multiple causes? Well, in all cases, the plaintiff walks in and says, the defendant is a cause. It's the defendant who comes back and says, well, there were other causes. Well, fine, if there were other causes, we have a way of dealing with that. But it doesn't mean that the defendant in this case was not a cause. All we had to do was present sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury could conclude that the defendant's conduct was a cause, and we did that. And for that reason, we asked the court to reverse the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Thank you again, Mr. Nimmo. We appreciate both of your fine arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.